From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. On this day before Veterans Day, we're bringing you a show rooted in the impact of wars on those who fight them. First, we speak with Dr. Sandra Marshall from the VA Maryland Healthcare System about what medical services are most needed among veterans. Then we talk about the gruesomeness behind the gallantry of the Civil War with historian Michael Adams, author of the book Living Hell, The Dark Side of the Civil War. Plus, a play at the intersection of video games and drone warfare, Leveling Up, is on stage at the Interrobang Theater Company. Critic Jaywin Russick brings us her review. And Washington College students in Chestertown have been interviewing veterans of World War II. We talk with a veteran, one of the students, and historian Adam Goodhart. First news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In honor of Veterans Day tomorrow, we're devoting most of our show today to the impacts of wars on the people who fight them. We begin with one of the most visible impacts, a veteran's health. More than 55,000 veterans in Maryland are served by the VA system. But vets in Maryland, like across the country, have had to deal with long wait times. A cover-up of long wait times to see VA doctors in Phoenix led last May to the resignation of the head of the VA, General Eric Shinseki. Robert McDonald, a former CEO of Procter & Gamble, took over the management of the Veterans Administration in late July. McDonald visited Baltimore last month as part of an effort to attract more doctors and nurses to the VA. And with me now to talk about veterans health care in our state is Dr. Sandra Marshall, Deputy Chief of Staff of the VA Maryland Healthcare System. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, a federal audit in June found Maryland vets faced the fourth longest wait time in the country to have an initial visit with a VA primary care doctor. Veterans were waiting 80 days on average, nearly 3 months. Why was that?
Well, we had some vacancies. We had a time when we had a number of providers for various reasons who had left the VA Maryland healthcare system, but we've put in place a very aggressive action plan, and we have been able to reduce the wait times by 17 days at this point. We also have taken a few months to get the VA Maryland healthcare system staff up to the level that we need. So we've now hired 13 additional primary care providers. We reintroduced Saturday primary care clinics. We added additional capacity to primary care appointments at all of our locations. And we also partner with a community provider, Evergreen Health, who was able to provide clinical access for our patients as well. So new veterans who enroll to the VA Maryland healthcare system can ask to be seen at the Evergreen healthcare system, and we can get them in that week.
Did I understand right? You said that the wait time has been cut by 17 days,
that's correct.
So now veterans are waiting an average of 63 days, still more than 2 months.
For those who do not need to be seen immediately for their health care, then that would be correct. For those that need to be seen for their health care at this time, we have the option of sending them to Evergreen Health Care. We also contacted hundreds of our veterans who were waiting to be seen and asked them whether they would like to have their appointment moved up. Any veteran who indicated that they would like to move their appointment up, we made accommodations to see them in one of our community-based or hospital-based clinics, and or we provided them the option of going to Evergreen Health. Our veterans are very committed and very loyal to the VA system, and most of them actually indicated that they wish to remain in the appointment that they were given and be seen through the VA Maryland healthcare system.
And what is an acceptable wait time?
Our goal is to have our veterans be seen based on their clinical needs. So those veterans who have urgent medical needs, we would get them in to be seen and that issue addressed at the time that they need it.
Describe the veteran whom you've seen most, from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, or from World War II, or from Vietnam.
Well, we see veterans from all conflicts, so the number of World War II veterans we see has diminished as those veterans have passed on. We do see a significant number of veterans, though, from all of the other conflicts. The fastest growing group of veterans that we're providing care for now are our women veterans.
From which era?
They're the younger female veterans, so that they tend to be from the Gulf War or from Operation Enduring Freedom or Iraqi Freedom.
And for each of these groups, what are the health issues that they are more likely to face than civilians?
The health issues that we see that our veterans face that are commonly not seen in the civilian populations are those related to the stress of being away at war. They come back sometimes with a post-traumatic stress disorder. The VA has been very proactive at doing research in various areas that are unique to combat and to veterans' health care. So we have issues such as those kinds of exposures to environmental agents that we address and care for in our veterans.
One other thing that crossed my mind, there was some local coverage of an increase in opioid prescriptions, which I think is probably true, an increase in painkiller prescriptions over the last decade throughout medical care. Is that a problem for veterans? We hear a lot.
The VA Maryland healthcare system has one of the lowest rates of opioid prescriptions, and we have a very extensive program in mental health for addressing, identifying those veterans who are in need of substance abuse treatment and counseling. We have integrated mental health care within our primary care clinics. So we actually have gone to implementing a program where we can have mental health in our primary care locations, have the veterans feel comfortable accessing that care, have it happen at the same time they come to their primary care visit, so that we can hopefully make a seamless transition between primary care and mental health and have those kinds of issues addressed with them. So we have very active programs in mental health and primary care that work together, and it's, I think, been very successful. We do have a chronic pain management system. We do have a number of services within the system. We can provide acupuncture, physical therapy. We do have the ability to fee patients who need to be seen for chiropractic care. So we're constantly looking at those types of services that veterans with chronic pain issues require.
I appreciate your talking to us. Thank you.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Dr. Sandra Marshall is Deputy Chief of Staff at the VA Maryland Healthcare System. If you're a veteran in need of care, you can sign up to become a VA patient at maryland.va.gov. We have a link to that website and more information at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Today's VA has its roots in the Civil War. Just ahead on Maryland Morning, we take a look at the brutal realities of that war. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead of Veterans Day tomorrow, we're reflecting on the experience of soldiers. A century and a half after the Civil War, our attempts to understand it may lead us to visit a preserved battlefield, which is now a park, or we may engage in a reenactment and get the feel of a rough wool uniform on a hot summer day. Historian Michael Adams argues, nothing we can experience today can take us anywhere close to the horror of the Civil War. The manicured battlefield doesn't show the mud, the pools of blood, the piles of manure and attendant insects that surrounded the soldiers. Our fellow reenactors look pretty healthy and well-adjusted. They're not barefoot, not fighting disease, hunger, and shell shock. Dr. Adams, retired Regents Professor of History at Northern Kentucky University, will be in Baltimore tomorrow to discuss his book, Living Hell, The Dark Side of the Civil War. He joins us on the line now from WNKU in Northern Kentucky. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Why did you feel this book needed to be written?
The reason I wanted to do this is that when you read the letters, memoirs, diaries of the period, you are absolutely startled by the candor and by the information that you learn. We think of the Victorians as repressed, but in fact they were not. The soldiers, the civilians, they talk about a lot of things that we don't often place front and center. For example, there was rape in the Civil War by soldiers. It's often said that there was very little, but I think there was. And the soldiers talk about the experience at a depth that, as you said, we cannot recreate in any other way but by going to their words. For example, and I should say parenthetically, I am certainly not opposed to reenacting. I think it's wonderful educational experience and material. But as an example, the slow-moving bullet of the period, the standard-issue mini-ball, 0.68 or 0.7 caliber, large lead bullet, did not usually exit the body. It was too slow, and it did terrible damage roaming. I call it traveling. So a soldier may say that his comrade was hit in the nose, the ball takes out his eyes, rattles around in his mouth, take out teeth, and exits his windpipe. We cannot recreate that in any other way except to bring those people back to be heard in their own voices. And the reason I think it's important is that war has had, continues to have, a very important role in our culture, other cultures, and we really should know as much as we can about it.
I was struck by the statistics you quote about how young the armies were, both the Union and Southern armies.
Yes. And for some of those boys, the experience was overwhelming. You know, there was a tendency to romanticize what was going to be the experience on the battlefield. They call it seeing the elephant, as though you were going to a circus show. And the horror of the firing line just overwhelmed some of them. They either deserted or, frankly, lost their senses. They didn't have a psychiatric vocabulary, so they called it shook over hell. These poor young men shook violently, and they often could not come back from it. Some did. We might even say many did, but they couldn't all handle it.
Yeah, you write about the mental wounds that were not really recognized as injuries of war.
Right. And this is something where I think we each have to determine how far we can speculate. There was not a psychiatric vocabulary, you know, we're 40-odd years or whatever from Freud and the other pioneers in psychiatry. And so the Civil War generation, when it looks at what is happening, goes to a much earlier vocabulary than we would use. They, for example, say that a soldier has lost his character, which is a little bit pejorative.
I guess.
Today, I think we'd say a veteran might have post-traumatic stress disorder. We wouldn't say that they'd lost their character. That's a bit of a moral judgment.
You also write that the technology of killing, you describe it as killing on an industrial scale. The technology had advanced more by 1860 than the practice of leading soldiers in battle, arranging them on the field.
Yes, very definitely. Technology, our apps tend to develop faster than our ability to adapt to them. So that in the Civil War, we have gone from the smoothbore musket firing a round ball that is not accurate over 50 to 75 yards. It flies wide. You probably couldn't hit a barn door at 100 yards with it. We have come to the rifle percussion musket, which is accurate, it is efficient, doesn't misfire. And that extends the effective range of the musket to perhaps 750 yards. The officers do not adapt to that change by and large. They still crowd the men together in shoulder-to-shoulder firing lines, blasting away at each other at criminal or suicidal ranges. I just did a little piece on one of Alfred R. Ward's sketches of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. It shows the Union and Confederate lines during Pickett's charge, the third day at Gettysburg, no more, I would say, than 15 yards apart. And at that range, the Springfield or Enfield musket was absolutely shattering. There is one, perhaps, extenuation for those officers, and that is that often the volunteers weren't well trained in musketry. They probably couldn't use the rifle musket as effectively as it could be technologically. But still, I do believe those officers failed to adapt. Some tried. For example, Francis Barlow, Union general, spread his men out into a thin skirmish line. He stopped that solid block of targets. Most didn't.
As Professor Emeritus Michael Adams here on 88.1 Maryland Morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his book, Living Hell, The Dark Side of the Civil War. Was disease a greater risk to soldiers than being wounded in battle?
Oh, yes, it was. I think the ratio was pretty well established to be 2-1, and there are a number of reasons for that. One is that medical science was still at a relatively primitive stage. Even if, let us say, doctors in the field wanted to be more hygienic in their operations, their treatment of patients, the water wasn't available. In the book, I talk about the armies as moving cities. They move across the landscape, 60, 70,000 men, and they all need water. They quickly exhaust the clean water supplies, so that physicians, for example, who are doing amputations, may just to have disgustingly bloody, filthy water in which to wash their tools and clean wounds. In addition to that, the volunteer soldiers were themselves a problem. There was a kind of democratic, I'm damned if I'm going to do that attitude to army rules and regulations that governed cleanly behavior, so that soldiers often, frankly, defecated outside of the latrines, the trenches. And of course, you couldn't do much about the fact that all of the army horses, thousands of animals, mules, were defecating. And so the armies were accompanied by millions of flies that spread disease. Bad food played a role. The soldiers often did not have good, fresh food, certainly not vegetables. So yes, disease was a terrible thing. And in addition, ironically, we think of country boys as more healthy often than the, you know, the products of the Victorian urban slum. But many country boys had grown up without being exposed to childhood diseases such as mumps, measles. And when they contracted these sicknesses as recruits, it could end up making them very sick or even killing them.
This book is so depressing to read. Was it was it hard to write?
Yes, I think it was. One of our sons said it was not the feel-good book of the season. But I think that the pleasure, if I can use that word, it's almost obscene, but the pleasure was in bringing back these voices and letting these people speak for themselves. That, for me, gave the project its value. I would say to someone, why would you want to read this book? Because those people have a right to be heard, not the famous ones, not those rationalizing why they decided to make this attack or not make it, but ordinary people who were the Americans who went through our bloodiest and in many ways most formative experience.
I really appreciate you talking to us. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Michael Adams, he's the author of the book Living Hell, The Dark Side of the Civil War. Tomorrow evening at the Ivy Bookshop, Adams and two other Civil War historians, Claudia Floyd and Ron Coddington, will discuss new perspectives on that war. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast. There's more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
Maryland Morning theater critic J. Wynn Russick has been to see the Interrobang Theater Company's production of Leveling Up. She brings us this review.
What's the likelihood? Baltimore has two plays running simultaneously about drone operators at a military facility in Nevada. The first, Grounded, at Everyman Theater, which I reviewed here last week, is about a female drone pilot. The second, Leveling Up, is produced by a new Baltimore company called Interrobang. It's about a video game whiz kid who's recruited by the National Security Agency. Both plays raise some of the same issues about drone warfare, especially the psychological ramifications for the drone operators, who hit targets thousands of miles away from their safe seats in front of screens. But while Grounded is about a veteran Air Force pilot, Leveling Up focuses on a 20-something championship gamer named Ian. He's so good at gaming, he gets paid to level up players who aren't as good.
People pay you to play?
To level them up.
Really?
Yeah, there are warehouses in China filled with kids playing all day and all night for these crazy rich dudes for like 200 a week. I can make twice that easy.
Wow.
That was Tim German, who gives a thoroughly believable portrayal of smart, self-assured Ian. Ian spends all his time playing video games in the basement apartment he shares with two roommates. That is, until NSA comes calling. It's a plot development that playwright Deborah Zoe Laufer based on fact, the military's recruitment of top gamers to do top-secret work alongside drone pilots. Ian's friends are concerned about how real killing, as opposed to virtual killing, might affect him. That's one of the play's central issues. The impact of this brand new warfare on those who operate the controls. Tim German's cocky Ian claims he's not worried. that to avoid psychological trauma, the agency also puts fictitious targets on his screen.
I won't know. I won't know if it's real. Look, it's not like I'm doing it. I don't give the order. I don't even know the guy who gives the order. By the time it's gotten down to me, it's gone through like 10 guys. If they don't use me, they're going to use somebody else. They're going to do it, with or without me. But if they use me, they'll know it'll get done right. Innocent people won't get killed because I'm incredibly skilled.
Of course, it doesn't work out that simply. Loffer's a more interesting playwright than that. In addition to warfare, she also examines the impact of video games on everyday human interaction. Almost every scene consists of the actors sitting with game controllers in their hands and their eyes glued to screens that are unseen by the audience. There's even a near-romance and near-sex scene conducted entirely on an unseen screen by Tavish Forsyth as one of Ian's roommates and Jessie Poole as the girlfriend of another. Deftly directed by Sarah Scafitti, this virtual love scene sends pheromones over the footlights. But after a while, there's a sameness to a play and a production with scene after scene of two or three actors seated on a sofa and another in an armchair. Of course, the character's immobility is part of the point. Have their lives become so virtual, so insular, they can only connect on screen? Interrobang Theater Company was founded by recent UMBC theater grads, so the ages of the actors are ideal for the characters. Only Todd Zakwija, who plays the female character's dim, gullible boyfriend, seemed a bit stiff at the first performance. That performance was part of the Charm City Fringe Festival, an event that's an excellent indicator of Baltimore's burgeoning young theater scene. Leveling Up is being performed at the Mercury Theater on North Charles Street, formerly home to the Strand. Interrobang, by the way, is the name of a new punctuation mark that combines a question mark and an exclamation point. Interrobang's Leveling Up doesn't always earn that exclamation point, but it definitely poses some up-to-the-minute questions. And, after all, leaving an audience mulling over big questions is a hallmark of good theater.
Maryland Morning Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. The Interrobang Theater Company's production of Leveling Up continues at the Mercury Theater through Sunday, November 16th. I'm Sheila Cast. Today on Maryland Morning, we're talking about the impact of war on the lives of those who fight. We turn now to a war that shaped the direction of the latter half of the 20th century, World War II. 16 million Americans served in that war. More than 1 million are still alive today, and 16,000 of them live in Maryland, according to the National World War II Museum. It is projected that by 2036, they will all be gone. A group of students at Washington College in Chestertown has been interviewing veterans as part of an oral history project called The Real War, World War II Veterans Remember. With us on the line from Washington College to talk about it is one of those veterans, 90-year-old Cy Ellenhorn, who was a waist gunner on a B-24 based in Italy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also joining us is one of the students who interviewed the veterans, Alex Foxwell. He's double majoring in drama and history at Washington College. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And Adam Goodhart, historian and director of the C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience. It sponsored the Real War Oral Histories Project. Welcome back to the show, Adam.
Great to be here, Sheila.
So, Adam Goodhart, how did this project start and what did it aim to do?
Yeah, the idea of this project was that we have history all around us here in Maryland and really in every community, stories that are waiting to be told and that haven't been written. And we were reminded of a remark that Walt Whitman made about the Civil War. He said, "The real war will never get into the books." And we became fascinated with this idea of the war that's written history and then the war that people remember, the experience of the war that often isn't recorded. And we wanted to get out into the community and capture that real war. And we thought it would be especially powerful if college students did this, because here are two generations, the greatest generation, so-called, and the millennial generation, so-called, that are separated by 7 decades. And from my experience, there's really something wonderful that happens when older people talk to much younger people It's different than if, you know, a middle-aged person like me sets out to do an interview. There's not that same feeling that knowledge that history is being passed on from one generation to another. And indeed, we found that when these veterans sat down to talk with 20-year-olds, I think the kinds of stories that they told are very different from the ones they might have told otherwise.
Cy Ellenhorn, you are one of the veterans who talked to the students. Tell us a bit of your story. How old were you on December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor?
Well, I'm 90 now, so I had to be about 17, 18.
Did you know on that day that you'd fight?
No, hardly. No, I had no idea.
Did you enlist?
No, I was drafted.
And how old were you then?
I would think about 18.
And you became a waste gunner. What does a waste gunner do?
He fires a machine gun at the enemy who was trying to take me down, me and the rest of the bomber crew, because we were heading toward the target with bombs. And they did their best to dissuade us.
And waste refers to you were in the center, the waste of the airplane?
Yes. There are 10 machine gun positions on a B-24. And one of them was the waist.
In your memory, what's the most exciting day of the war?
Wow, excitement. How are we going to rate excitement?
Well,
frightened?
Okay, the scariest.
I guess when I had to bail out of the bomber into the Adriatic Sea.
Oh my, tell us that story.
Well, we're coming back from a mission. I think it was Munich that we were coming back from, and there was a lot of flak, and coming back, we ran out of gas, and there was no place to land, and we had a choice of bailing out or ditching, and the pilot suggested by ringing a bell that we bail out, and three of us bailed out, and one was never found.
Oh, so my.
It was on the 16th of December, 1944.
Not too long from the end of the war, but you didn't know that then.
No.
What did you do when you got home?
I took 2 weeks off after I was discharged from the service and went to work for a firm that imported firearms. So I was essentially a gunsmith at the time, and that worked out throughout my life. And I was in the gun business in New York City.
Did that build on skills you'd learned during the war, or was that something you'd
no,
wanted to
I
do
didn't.
Before?
No, I've done that before I went into the service, and I was classified as an armorer. And when I got out, I just picked it up again and went to work for the same firm that I worked for before the war.
On WIPR, this is Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Cy Ellenhorn, who was a waste gunner on a B-24 based in Italy during World War II. Also with us is Alex Foxwell, a Washington College junior who interviewed World War II veterans as part of an oral history project there. And Adam Goodhart, an historian and director of the C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience at Washington College. Let me pull Alex Foxwell into this. What did you learn from the World War II vets whom you interviewed?
What I've learned over the past year or so, all these stories that I've heard from these World War II veterans and people that have experienced the war is basically, it's another version of what I grew up listening to in my grandparents' house, at home. Both of my grandfathers were World War II veterans, and my grandmother is a Holocaust survivor. So I've more or less grown up.
She was a Jew who lived in France. Is that correct?
Yes, my grandmother was a French Jew. She's still with us. She hid throughout the south of France. So, what I've really picked up from this whole experience is that no one's experience is more valid than the other, and every person's experience is worthwhile to listen to.
I would have thought you sort of knew that already.
Well,
but
yeah.
How did that come home to you in a deeper way?
The whole point of this project, especially what I found, is to make the personal accessible to the greater audiences, especially, you know, something that deviates from the normal World War II narrative of, you know, we fought the Nazis, we fought the Japanese, we won the end. You know, we want to get into the real nitty gritty rather than reading what's in the textbooks. and personal experiences from this wide range of people, you know, is exactly what we've been looking for, especially for my generation, to come to terms with World War II and its lasting legacy.
Adam Goodhart, what has it been like to watch students work with the veterans?
It's wonderful, the energy that's there. It's exciting for the veterans, I think, to be collaborating with these very energetic, very curious and excited college students. And I also think it's marvelous for the students themselves to be hearing about these events that, frankly, they seem so distant in time. In most of my work, I'm a scholar of the Civil War. And the other day I was in a room full of these veterans and college students, and I realized that these World War II veterans are separated from the college students by about as much distance as Civil War veterans were separated from these World War II veterans when they were young. If that makes sense. There's the same distance. It's about 70 years. So for these students today to sit down and talk with World War II veterans would be like a college student in the 1930s talking to a Civil War veteran. So it's kind of magical. You know, what would we give today to be able to interview a veteran of the Battle of Gettysburg, or someone who saw Lincoln's second inaugural address? And there were a few of those interviews that were recorded back while those veterans were alive, but not enough. And it really makes one feel the urgency of recording these histories while there's still the opportunity to do that.
All the veterans the project talked to are from the Eastern Shore?
All of them are from the East. Well, all of them live on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, although their experiences really range pretty widely, including people who lived in Europe during the war and shared their stories. And we really feel that when we say veterans, we don't simply mean people who fought as members of the armed services. We mean people who lived through that experience and participated and contributed, because, of course, there are many ways that people participated in the experience of World War II and contributed to the effort of winning that war beyond picking up a gun and putting on a uniform.
Alex, you're part of a group of students putting together a stage performance tomorrow night with material drawn from interviews from the local World War II veterans like Cy. How did you approach telling their story?
Our major approach is that we really wanted to be as authentic as possible. So what I and the creative team have done, we've taken the transcripts of these oral history interviews and have revised them to kind of be these potable scenes to put on stage, small little vignettes to intersperse throughout other parts of the program. What we really wanted to do is to bring these interviews to life on stage, to put a body with the voice rather than just to listen to the clip. As valuable as the audio clips are, and they are extremely valuable, making this kind of a production requires also a lot of emotional soul searching for the creative team, especially, you know, and for the actors that portray these veterans, these people who have had all these experiences. So what we've really tried to do is to kind of get into the meat of the text, the meat of these, you know, of these audio clips, and figure out, well, what drives these people? What drove this generation who were the same age as these actors that are on stage now? So, like, I'm 20 years old. Cy, when you were 18, had just been drafted into the Army Air Corps. That is unbelievable for me. So what we've really tried to do is to relate this to us. How are we different? Why is it important? And how can we both celebrate and learn from it?
Cy, did you learn anything from being interviewed?
Oh, yeah. They had a difficult time understanding. For instance, one girl asked me what a Mae West was. So,
and how did you answer that question?
She didn't know there was a person called Mae West. And the life vest that we had, when you fill them up with air, you pulled a line and it pierced a capsule and it automatically filled the Mae West, and it makes a very buxom person out of you. So.
So that's one way to answer that question.
Yeah, and then they had a hard time understanding that we had electric suits with booties and leggings and jackets and gloves that they all plugged into one another, and we pushed a plug into the cabin, and so we were warm. Normally it's pretty darn cold up there.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Cy Ellenhorn served in World War II as a waste gunner on a B-24 based in Italy. Alex Foxwell is a history and drama double major at Washington College who interviewed World War II veterans as part of the Real War Oral History Project there. Historian Adam Goodhart directs the C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience, which sponsored the Oral History Project. Washington College will present a multimedia staged performance based on transcripts of interviews with World War II veterans. That's tomorrow night, 7:30, in Decker Theater at the Gibson Center for the Arts on the campus. We've got links to the details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Also there, a link to the Starr Center's website, where you can hear all the veterans' interviews. Maryland Morning is an original production of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. The show is produced by Matt Purdy. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We have production help from Connor Graham, Payam Agagasem, and Elizabeth Sherwood. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. See you Wednesday.